Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
We had a little hiatus last week as Adam and I headed back to Canada to visit family for the holiday. If you're watching on YouTube, we also have a bit of a different setup today. And even if you're listening on a podcast app, it might sound a little different as well because we got locked out of our regular recording location. So we have hidden ourselves up in our loft
with some borrowed equipment,
hoping that this will work. So this is hopefully temporary. So we apologize for the last minute setup here. But aside from our own difficulties, things have been quite busy.
Ooh, it was a good week.
And we've got a lot to unpack, particularly on the NCAA men's side of things. The conference tournaments all happened this past weekend, so we're going to dive into a bit of that. All of the pro leagues are finishing up their seasons, so you know what that means. International season is upon us, everybody. We're very excited for that.
I thought you were going to say Champions League final.
Well, yeah, I'm excited for Champions League final, but international season too. Like, come on. We can all cheer for our countries. Tell me where you're from. We are so excited to be back with you after our little break, and we are ready to talk volleyball. So let's get started. All right, first things first, the NCAA women have been happening. We can't escape them. We don't want to escape them is more like it, okay? But we did get several questions about the spring season, so I did want to touch on it in our highlights. The NCAA women have been playing their spring season over the last few weeks. So we got numerous emails and questions about the Penn State Pitt match and how that was on TV. So one question that kind of summarizes everything was, did you and Adam watch it, first of all? And what were your thoughts? As a player at Nebraska, did you have spring matches? And did you like them or find them useful? So here's the thing. We did have spring matches. They were a thing even when I was in college. Too long ago to talk about.
Okay. I don't remember if I like them or not.
I'm repping Nebraska with my t-shirt today, though. We did have them. But back then, they were not televised. They were very much exhibition feel. Just like very low-key. We didn't really travel far from them. We always hosted our spring matches. We would go somewhere for spring break. And so we would travel for those, like we went to Hawaii or San Diego or Florida or places like that, because like, let's get out of the Nebraska winter. But we would host like local programs, like D2 schools in Nebraska, the other D1 schools, Wichita State, like people who are close by. Very low key, not a big deal, but they have definitely gotten more popular. I guess I still see spring season as what I experienced, like teams testing out their potential rosters after graduating players, after losing players to the portal, after bringing in their freshmen who graduated early. So I see it as very experimental and
there's no rankings.
Yeah.
Consequences. So that is 100% what it is.
So we didn't watch because I kind of still have that attitude toward them. But Pitt and Penn State played. I saw Nebraska played Kansas yesterday. So there, if you are missing NCAA women's volleyball, you can check out the updated rosters and see how people are looking. But we didn't watch them. And even as a player, it was nice to kind of get those competitive juices flowing again after a few months off. But would I consider them like super useful? Not really.
I mean, if you're starting every match in the season and you're playing, then yes, probably not useful. For athletes who have worked on something or didn't get a chance to play, I'm sure it's nice to get on the court and do some of those things. So it's a useful tool, I would say, for the coaches.
And I mean, back then, you didn't even have players graduating high school early to get an extra semester in. Like, if anything, you would see girls come in May and spend the summer there. Like, that was the, like, new thing back when I played. So it's like a completely different landscape now.
Well,
I understand why.
With no real transfer portal, like, it would have just been more of an opportunity for your young players, red shirts, to come in and...
100%.
Yeah.
100%. So that's happening. Check it out if you're interested. They have the games posted on YouTube as well, we noticed yesterday. So check those out.
I mean, if you're watching any volleyball this past week, it should have been the men's NCAA because there were some fantastic matches.
Ooh. On the Italian side, because you know how much we love to talk about the Italian leagues, Conegliano swept Milano 3-0 in the A1 Italian women's final.
It wasn't even really...
Conegliano's just like light years better.
They're so good.
So that's their 8th title, 7th in a row, by the way. So in the Turkish league, Vakıfbank won. So we'll be seeing all 3 of those teams in the Champions League semifinals, final 4 in a few weeks. But on the men's side, we were thinking things were cut and dry. We were wrong. Perugia was up 2-0 on Civitanova. Next thing, I blinked and Civitanova took the series 3-2.
This is why you do playoffs as a best of 3 or a best of 5, right here.
Crazy. Honestly, though, that was an upset.
I know.
But good for Civitanova because they had to show up.
But upsets are fine if you've got to earn it. Mm. Like, it's not a mistaken upset if you win 3 of 5 or 2 of 3. Like,
I mean, like, you're a good team.
Yes.
At that point. Like, you've proven that you can do it. So we've got Civitanova taking on Trento. At the time of our recording, you know, we record on Sundays, match 1 is happening. So matches 2 and 3 are going to be happening this week. So lots of excitement in Europe as well.
On the love front, we got a ton of feedback from those of you who would, I think, call yourself casual volleyball viewers. And
because Adam did ask a very specific question.
I did. And to be honest, I thought there were going to be a ton of negative comments. And I thought people were going to disagree with us wholeheartedly.
Oh,
however, 100%. I don't think I saw one person kind of disagreeing with what we were saying, at least online from what I could saw. And I'm on the Facebook. You're doing more of the Instagram stuff. But I was surprised to see the same feedback from people, and I do appreciate everybody who reached out to us and gave us your opinions, and I hope that the Love League is getting some of that feedback, because I think there's a ton of potential there, and it would be great if they made some of the adjustments that some people were talking about. But I enjoyed that dialogue, so thanks for everybody who took the time to write in and engage with us.
And to give us that perspective.
Absolutely.
Because we were like, okay, if you are a casual viewer, if you live with a casual viewer, please let us know what your experience was. And yeah, you guys agreed. So thank you for that feedback. We thought we were out in left field.
Well, we just weren't sure if we shared, given our volleyball background, the same opinion as people who haven't been in the sport at the same level. So that was really interesting to read. I really enjoyed that. In other Love news, Eric Sullivan has been named the head coach of Austin. He was also recently named the head coach of the USA Women's National Team program. I think this is a curious move.
I got so many messages about this.
So my initial thought was it's a very shrewd move by Love because it's going to allow them to keep some of their young players playing in the league, I think. And I think that was the motivation behind it. Now, lots of coaches go overseas to coach when they're not with their national programs. This allows Eric to be in the U.S., to see more players, to be close to the national team. It makes a ton of sense for him, I think. It also allows Love to align closely with the national team program. And I would imagine that some athletes are going to feel comfortable being there and allowing them to see him versus going overseas. So I think it was a shrewd business move on Love's side.
My knee-jerk reaction to this was to scream from the rooftops, conflict of interest. I have taken more time to think about this in the last several days. So the reason I thought it was a conflict of interest is because we have had so many conversations about, like, who's going to be the starting outsides for the national team? Who's going to play opposite? And when you got, like, a Madison Skinner, for example, who was playing for Austin, to have her in front of Sullivan's face every day, and I understand she played college for him as well, I just felt like it would give her kind of an unfair advantage or look. That is why that was my gut reaction. And as Adam mentioned, and a lot of people I realize don't know this, is a ton of national team coaches do coach professionally. You often see it in Europe, in Brazil, like the Brazilian coaches, they coach club teams and stuff too. The thing though that I have noticed is the club, the national team coaches don't really have a say of which of their national team players come with them. They do, however, have a say when it comes to the low price players, the bench players. So they will often take a young developmental player from their national team who they know won't start, but they need to get practice. And they will take those players with them overseas to get extra training. But the national team coaches are often coaching like super high powered teams in really good leagues. So the budgets are huge and the management doesn't care who you coach on your national team. They just want to win championships. This move is not the same to me. It's not the same. For me, I see this as Love being like, we need a way to keep our players in the U.S. And I wonder, honestly, this just came to my mind, I wonder how long this was in the works, because Chiaka Agbagu was taken off of every VACF Bank post. So I'm wondering if she left her contract that she recently signed to stay when she found out that Sullivan was going to be in Austin.
Well, I mean, absolutely that was Love's intention behind it. But I don't see it as, it's a win-win-win for a lot of different people. Now, whether it works out long-term for the U.S. national program, that remains to be seen. But Love wants to keep U.S. athletes here, right? Eric Sullivan will be a draw for that. If I was coaching a national team, I would want to coach my players. Because
I would want my players to play with and against the best every single day.
I don't disagree.
I don't know if I take the same stance as you on that. I can't, as if I'm Eric Sullivan and I'm staying in Austin, I can't offer my potential national team players the level of day-to-day competition and training that another, like a top league can.
Fair.
And I would want them to go get that experience.
But if they're going to stay anyway, you
but
would
if
rather...
they're staying for you, it's like a chicken and egg discussion here. Like, yeah. Why are they staying?
But so Madison played in Austin last year anyway. She probably could have gone overseas, right? If she's going to stay again, you get a chance to work with her. It's the athlete's choice. They all know what's going on. I mean, I definitely see why Love was doing it.
But as a young, impressionable athlete, you are inherently going to feel more pressure to stay there because you want to make a good impression. I don't think you're going to necessarily have the foresight to look elsewhere. You're going to feel so much pressure to stay to like try to make that impression. I don't know.
I mean, it depends on what Eric's messaging is too. Maybe it's like, hey, I get to coach a whole young developmental team and I'm trying to push my top player. Like, we don't know what those conversations are. It's an interesting move given how Love operates and what Eric's goals are with the national team. which has to be a gold medal in 2028. So I'm very curious to see how this plays out. It's an interesting experiment. In other love news, several of the athletes have gone to Indonesia to compete in the remainder of the Indonesian Pro League after the love season wrapped up. So that includes Jess Merzik, Maddie Rischel, Kelsey Cook, and Jordan Thompson. What do you think about that?
Well, given the fact that during the semi, they were talking about how Jess Merzik is going to go to Indonesia but not play national team, I was like, what? Like, why? Maddie Rischel, she's played there, just make some extra money. Like, she's not really a national team athlete. Kelsey Cook has said that she's taking the summer off, so maybe her and her husband went to have, like, a nice vacation after, like, play for 3 weeks and just chill.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like, do you need to supplement your income? Like, why?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of defeats the purpose of a local league to me. You want the athletes to be able to stay home to make a living, but then they feel like they have to go overseas to make more money.
Like, and how much it was rammed down our throats of like, oh, these athletes, so happy that they're playing at home. And they're like, thank you so much. Now we're going to go overseas. Like,
and I mean, I get it for Maddie and Kelsey. Do what you want to do. That's fine. Jordan Thompson, if she's playing national team, that surprises me a little bit.
And the league isn't even good.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going.
You're going purely for money.
What are they even paying? Because in my experience, I never played in Indonesia, but from what I understand, it's not a great league. It's pretty bad. And they're not like paying a ton of money. Like,
yeah, maybe vacation. I don't know. I thought it was curious.
Just take a vacation after your season then. Like, don't like pretend. I don't know. It was confusing.
And we also saw that Madison Skinner and Amber Ejiji both alluded to coming back next year and continuing to play. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. And then we also are kind of up in the air with what Obagu is going to do next year. She was supposed to go to Vaketh Bank, but she's nowhere to be found on their website now. So I think
she was removed from all of their social media posts.
My assumption is that she's coming back to love.
Where do I feel about that?
Yeah, guys. We'll see what happens in all of those situations.
On the NCAA men's side, it was the make or break weekend. Let's call it that. Whoever won their conference tournament gets the automatic qualifying bid to nationals. There are only two at-large bids up for grabs. So we have seven conferences here. There was a lot of weird stuff that happened. Okay, so we've primarily on the podcast been following the three biggest conferences, the MPSF, the Big West, and MIVA. So for the conferences outside of those three, the automatic qualifiers were Fort Valley State, Belmont Abbey, Damon, and Penn State, which we had so many concerns about Penn State this season. Thank God for them that they play in that conference and not MIVA, because
I think they were 0-8 at the beginning of the season.
Oh my gosh, it was probably worse than that. They were limping. That's generous.
Crawling.
Like, willing. I don't know what they were doing, but it was not looking good. But somehow they miraculously managed to win their conference tournament and beat Princeton in the final.
I'm very curious to see what they look like at Nationals, because I haven't watched them since those early debacles.
I'm not hopeful. But anyway. In MIVA, we ended up having a 1-3 matchup in the final. We had Loyola Chicago, who finally beat Lewis in the semi after losing both matches to Lewis earlier this year. Ohio State beat McKendree. And so
Ohio State wasn't ranked high enough for McKendree to beat.
That's true. Ohio State was ranked under McKendree for a long time. So McKendree's like, meh, we only beat people ranked ahead of us. But we watched the Loyola Chicago game against Ohio State, and Loyola Chicago crushed them 3-0.
This week, I think I watched one of the most entertaining volleyball games that I've seen in a long time. And this one might have been one of the worst games that I've watched. Ohio State was nowhere to be found.
It was like, I was kind of embarrassed watching it.
It wasn't easy to watch.
It wasn't even close. No. Like Loyola Chicago wiped the floor with them. And like Shane Wetzel has been Ohio State's go-to guy all season. Did nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nobody could put the ball down. It was hard to watch.
Well, the scores were 25-10, 25-17, and the third set was 25-21, but they scored a bunch of points at the end. Like, at no point did you ever think Ohio State had a chance of winning.
Absolutely not.
Well, here were their hitting percentages. So as a team, in the first set, they hit negative 077. In the second set, they hit 156. And in the third set, they hit 250, which is respectable, but it doesn't count when your opponents hit 455 in the first set and then 500 as a team in the next two sets. Like, it was all credit to Loyola. They played well. They served well. They were in system on literally every pass.
I blocked them every ball.
Yeah. I think they passed a 5-0 on the match.
It was off the charts.
Yeah. They had 12 blocks. It was so lopsided, it wasn't even worth watching.
I was kind of sad that I like spent time watching that game because it was so bad. Loyola Chicago 100% deserved to win that.
Absolutely.
So they are the MEVA representative at Nationals.
And I'm actually really curious to see how they do. And this is the thing. Teams, whatever happens in the preseason, but they've had their season to develop. They're not necessarily as big and physical as some of the teams from the other top two conferences, but they are very skilled. So I'm very curious to see what those matchups look like.
On the MPSF side,
what?
We had some upsets to get to the final, everybody. Okay. Stanford upset BYU in one of the quarters.
I mean, Stanford,
we thought they packed it in like weeks ago.
I mean, we said at the beginning of the season, they played some good matches. They were a team that they're super young. You thought that they were consistent and that teams had to beat them. And I was hopeful for them at the beginning of the season. And then the wheels fell off in the middle of the season. They couldn't win a match to save their lives. They looked terrible. And then they come back and upset in the conference finals, which as a team, like, you want to play well in the conference finals. But that was a bit of a shock to me.
The other shock was on the other side of the bracket. Pepperdine upset UCLA in the semi. Although Pepperdine was hosting.
Yes.
But is that an excuse? I don't think so.
We didn't watch that game, but we did watch Pepperdine play USC in the final. And they were very good.
Really good. Well, okay. Let's qualify that.
Are we going to get into this?
Sure. We'll just touch on it. Their left sides were very good. And I think that's all I've got to say. Their left side, right, Barnett was unstoppable. I kept being like, how can they literally not stop this guy?
He was unconscious. Every single thing he hit from anywhere on the court, he could have hit balls from the baseline and he would have
scored. He could have passed balls over the net and scored. Like, that's kind of what it was like. Everything he touched, he just scored on. And I'm like, this is ridiculous.
He had 45 attempts and he hit 333 against the best blocking team in the NCAA, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
It was absolutely wild to watch. And this is the one thing that's often interesting about men's volleyball, specifically in the college space, is that there's a lot of physical players who can do a lot of different things. And if somebody gets hot who hasn't done anything all year or you haven't game planned for, sometimes there's nothing you can do. And quite frankly, both their left sides got unconsciously hot at the end of the season.
Well, somebody tell me where this number 7 came from.
Haver.
We had George Dyer playing left side for the whole season. And then all of a sudden I tune into this game and Haver is playing. Like, who is this kid?
I think he had 7 points in the first.
Okay, somebody tell me where he came from and what the deal with that is, because I was so confused, because you guys also know how I felt about George Dyer all season and how he just wasn't it. So, like, great job by number 7. But as impressive as the Pepperdine left sides were, I was equally unimpressed by Caleb Blanchett on USC's side, the setter. I didn't think USC played poorly. Like, they're what, like, watching them play, I wasn't like, wow, they're just not in it today. The only person I felt with that, and it's a critical position, was Blanchett, because I have loved him all season, how he's forced the middle, how he's run his offense really nice and quick, blah, blah, blah. But he was not good.
None of their hitters looked like they were in rhythm all night. It was tough. Their middles, who normally do a great job, I didn't think were utilized enough. And I thought they passed pretty well. And he was just off, and the team could not get going. Because I don't think they should have lost that match.
No, I don't think so either.
And the interesting thing was they're normally a very good blocking team, and they blocked really well against Cole Hartke, who had a rough night. I think he hit negative. So he got 42 sets. He's the right side for Pepperdine. He got 42 sets, and he hit negative on the night. And so you have to think that USC's game plan was probably, we got to shut down Cole. Okay, he gets the majority of their sets, and we're going to make other people beat us.
But they just played Pepperdine a couple weeks ago, and Barnett was really good against them then too. Like, hello.
Yeah, I mean, they shut down the big right side, but the left sides killed them. And I was expecting more of the USC middles as well, to be honest.
Well, they weren't getting the ball nearly as much as they usually do. Yeah. Like, well, I'm sorry to say, like, I don't want to lay this on one person's shoulders, but like, Blanchett didn't do his job.
Yeah, fair. If you look at the middles for USC, Guinness only got 9 sets and Tompkinson only got 11. And I thought that had been a strength of USC all year. And I thought they had the edge in the middle against Pepperdine, or should have. And it just didn't connect. They didn't use them. And I mean, that to me, that was on the Sutter.
Well, USC's hopes at nationals are gone now, I think.
I agree. I don't think they're getting an at-large bid.
So Pepperdine is coming out of the MPSF, which only leaves the Big West. And we're going to talk about this match in more depth, because as head-scratching as some of the other matches we watched were, this one was so entertaining. And Hawaii beat Long Beach State 3-1 to earn the Big West bid to nationals.
One of the most fun games I have watched in a very long time.
It was really good. It was so fun.
Super entertaining. And I will say before we wrap up that if you put money on Pepperdine to win the conference championship at the beginning of this year, you will be very rich at this point. Because I don't think anybody saw that either one of USC or UCLA not coming out of this conference.
I was going to say for Big West, I'm pretty satisfied, because I've been like a fan of Hawaii all season. And I'm like so happy that they put it together when it really mattered, because I was like, they have the potential. This team is so good. But anyway, the automatic qualifiers are set. The biggest question that remains is which two teams are going to get the at-large bids.
Well, I think it has to go to Long Beach and UCLA.
That is my instinct of who's going to get them. If you listen to the Big West broadcast, they think that they should get both.
No, it's not. It's not happening.
The Big West thinks that they should get both at-larges. Long Beach and UCLA held the 1-2 spot for the majority of the season. I would be shocked if it wasn't those two teams. UCLA also played a tough schedule, much tougher in my opinion than the non-conference schedule, much tougher than Long Beach State's. So I think that needs to be in a consideration. They are my two picks.
I think that those are picks, and I think they're safe, right? You're not going to ruffle any feathers. They're the top two teams that didn't make it, and I would be shocked if that's not the case. Looking to the PVF, which is still ongoing, Vegas has managed to get a couple wins in the last little while.
Woo!
So that's good for them. They've kind of righted the ship. I'm not sure if it's going to be too little too late, but we will see how that works.
They still have a chance.
They still have a chance, but things have got to work in their favor at this point, and they got to keep winning. Atlanta finally beat Omaha, which is good to see. I'm not sure if Omaha is still caring as much. I think they've locked up the seat, but
they've locked up a seat.
Yeah.
Maybe not first. They need to keep winning.
Yeah. We'll see what happens, but that's a good win for Atlanta. Grand Rapids beat Indy again. So that was interesting. Entering the last week of regular season play, Omaha, Atlanta, and Orlando are all safe. They're going to be in the 4-team playoff. The fourth spot is still up for grabs. Indy has a good cushion, but Grand Rapids and Vegas still have a chance if they continue to win and they lose a few matches. So
it's like they have the points, but they don't seem to play a role in how they do the rankings. But like Indy's a couple games ahead of them, but their points are so much higher. So I'm like, is that the tiebreaker? Is that what they're going to use if the other teams get those two wins? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. And I couldn't find anything online in terms of what the tiebreak procedures were. You'd have to think they mean something.
So Indy should be safe, but if we're looking at straight win-loss, Grand Rapids and Vegas still do have a chance if they win out.
Yeah. But they control their own destiny. So we'll see what happens there, and then playoffs will get started, and we'll be deep in the PVF playoffs once they start.
We had a lot of opinions mixed into our weekly update. So we're not just results today, everybody.
Well, with the men's playoffs, we watched a few of those matches. I think we needed to talk about them and give them a little bit of airtime. And
nothing happened in love on the court, but we still have opinions, okay?
Well, they're still drawing people in and there's players that we're following and it'll be interesting. I'm curious to see what the PVF playoffs look and feel like. We didn't watch them last year, but I like how they've laid out the league. I'm curious what we're going to see. So I am looking forward to watching those playoffs when the regular season is done. All right, so we're going to talk about two matches in full breakdown, I guess.
Well, how much? There's not a ton to talk about with our first match. We just kind of, we wanted to talk about it to give it a nice little bow on the season.
Well, and I think it may, like, Conegliano is
probably... We're talking about the Italian League final.
Yes. And Conegliano is probably the best women's team out there, hands down. I would be shocked if they didn't win the Champions League. They're a ton...
Adam just jinxed them, basically.
I don't believe in that. They're just so good. They're fun to watch. If you haven't had a chance, I think they have highlights. You might be able to find the game on YouTube, but... They're just so good.
They're just better. I expected this series, not necessarily, I didn't think Milano was going to win the series, but I was like, you know what? They could potentially take a match off of them. Like, mind you, Conegliano's lost one match all season.
Yeah.
So was that realistic? Was that naive of me? Maybe.
I mean, you think you got to be on for 3 games in a row. You know, you have the ability for one team to push. We watched them in the Coppa Italia. It was close-ish, at least in a couple sets. But this one, they ran through 25-22, 25-20, 25-21, and it never really was close. I mean, I think that Conegliano is just better all around, almost in every position. And if Milano was going to have a chance, Iguanu was going to have to outplay Hawk. And... That didn't happen.
Didn't happen.
I will say, I thought Iguanu served better than Hawk.
Yeah.
She dug more balls than Hawk, but Hawk doesn't dig any balls.
Hawk is just there to score points. True. Her defense leaves a little to be desired.
Bit of a black hole.
She scores so many points, who cares?
But Hawk attacked and blocked. She was the difference in the match. It was impressive to watch. She was very good.
She was very good. But the thing is, though, I feel like Hawk is able to do that for Conegliano because of all the other pieces around her. Their middles, Kitikella and Farr, like, they are run just enough to keep the middles on the other team honest, and they are, when they get set, they are almost unstoppable.
Yeah.
So they don't use them often. It's just like the outside core of Conegliano in Gabi, Zhuting, and Hawk are so good that they kind of carry the load, but the middle, you can't sleep on the middle, so you just see so many opportunities being created, and the way that they are able, they're running their back row in the gaps.
I was gonna talk, go ahead.
Off of the middle, who isn't even run all that often, it's just like impressive. So Hawk is a star. don't get me wrong, but the team in general and the ball control generated by Moki, DeGennaro, and Gabi allows them to run just an in-system offense. And then their middles you have to respect, and then their outside score, and then Hawk is like pretty much guaranteed to, like, it's just a pleasure to watch them.
It's just so well executed. They were in system all night. They pass so well. And the thing that impressed me was just how they attack the different zones. Like you mentioned, the middles will run a slide and they'll move the right side in, or the middles will run a quick and they'll run just over top, or the 30, like, they attack from all different zones, and the setter runs an offense where there's always an empty hitter.
Yeah.
Versus a split block, and she does such a great job of finding them. They're so well oiled, and there's no gaps in any position. It's, you want to watch the best high level volleyball, this is it in every regard.
The thing about Milano, though, and Egonu is one of the best opposites in the world, hands down. I think her job is made substantially more difficult because they don't have the same pieces that Conegliano does. Like, Anna Danese is an incredible blocker in the middle, but they weren't running the middle much.
No.
And their left sides do not bring enough offensively to take any type of attention away from Egonu. She needs to be scoring just lights out for them to have a chance. I think they are a really good team, but it's just, Conegliano has people scoring in every single position, and it's much more inconsistent on Milano's side. And it makes Egonu not scoring every single ball that much more obvious.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. She was still very good. She hit 290 and she got set 37 times. But to me, the difference, Milano needs a Hawk. So when Hawk swings, generally the play ends.
Somebody's scoring.
Like, she is scoring, or the play ends. There's not a lot of middle ground with her. Egonu, when I watched, she's not as aggressive. She tipped a lot. And I think that she looks like she's more error adverse, and she'll keep a play going, or she'll, and that's tough when you always have two blocks when, you know, the rest of your teammate isn't open. But in Milano, when you don't have as many other point scorers, you have to be a little bit more terminal. I'm not sure that her style of play professionally, and I haven't watched her enough to say, like, this is always how she plays, but in general, that team makeup needs a more aggressive right side, in my opinion. I think she tipped too many balls, even though she was good and she didn't want to make errors. Like, Hawk made 8 errors, I believe, on the match, and Egonu only made 3. They needed a few more points out of her if they were going to win.
Well, and also, I am an Alessia Oro fan, the setter for Milano. I didn't think she set the best game I've seen her play. I do think some of her sets were trailing tight. I think out of system, they were kind of setting Egonu a little too far off the net. So was it Oro's best match that I've seen her play? Absolutely not. I think she's better than that. Also, Miriam Sila wasn't playing. Like, she came off the bench in every set, but I'm like, was she struggling throughout the series? Like, we watched match 1, she started. Mm-hmm. We just missed match 2.
They needed her to be better. They needed her to stand out in that
series. No, and she's just like an energy boost on the team too. Like, even if she's not playing her best, like, she is the energy on that team. You're not getting it from Danese or Egonu or people like that. Like, she is it. And in the hostile environment, like, they're playing away, like, you need somebody to keep people together. I don't know. At the end of the day, Conegliano was just better.
Yeah, it wasn't as entertaining a match, other than the fact that the volleyball was a super high level. And I did look up the stats as we were chatting. Hawk only made 3 errors, so disregard where that 8 came from. She was pretty lights out. I misread that. Yeah. One, she got 3 errors and was blocked once. And Egonu made 3 errors and was blocked twice. Hawk was just pretty fantastic.
She was very good.
So,
very good.
I did enjoy watching just to see the level of volleyball. But from a competitive standpoint, it wasn't super competitive.
It was such like a joy to watch such talented athletes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, of course there are errors. Of course we can pick it apart all we want, but it's just like, it was just like so good.
If you could draw up how you would want your team to play, Conegliano executed that match.
Check it out. Highly recommend. Yeah. Or if you don't want to check it out and you want to wait for Champions League, this is actually going to be a rematch. It's going to be the semifinal. These teams are playing again in a neutral location this time in Istanbul. So maybe that'll have an effect. Who knows?
Well, it's always hard to beat a team multiple times. And they beat them in Coppa Italia. And they beat them
Supercoppa.
In the league. And they beat them in the playoffs.
And so, Supercoppa.
Yeah.
Like in every single thing. So
can they put the sweep on?
I want to say yes, because I love excellence. I just like, I feel like teams that have proven themselves to be excellent, just, it breaks my heart when they don't see it to the finish line.
Well, the one thing I think Milano can do, I mean, there's obviously lots of things, but I think they need to engage Hawk in her defensive position. They need to tip the ball to her. They need to swing cross court. They need to drive their offensive play to that side of the court.
She doesn't dig tip.
Well, to make her play defense and also to take her out of. Like, they tipped a few times and she had to come to the ground, and then you can load up your block. Like, I think there's some things that they can do against Conegliano so that they're not always firing on all cylinders.
In listening to the timeouts, they seemed overly preoccupied with their defensive positioning and their defensive strategy on Hawk. I didn't hear them talk much about their offensive strategy. But even so, they weren't doing what the coach wanted them to defensively. Like, I was listening to this being like, you guys, what?
Yeah.
But yeah, Volosh, the setter for Conegliano, is definitely a liability at the net. You've got Hawk digging behind her down the line. Trust me, as somebody who has dug behind many a small setter, you don't want to be at the attack line, so you have to be deep. Otherwise, you're getting pelted in the face, which you're exposing yourself to tips. You need to yo-yo Hawk back and forth on defense, like Adam was saying. Like, they can definitely do more than they did, but that means setting their left side.
Yeah.
And the left side needs to do something.
Or run your pipe and attack that side of the court.
They do not run the pipe. Yeah. That is another thing. They need to use either Move and Gonu more in the back row, or get your left sides going on the pipe, because they're too good.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see if they make any of those adjustments. I will definitely be watching that game. But yeah, I'm glad we chose this one to watch.
All right. We got some serious flack for not covering this matchup.
And rightly so.
Rightly so, but we had a lot to cover with love. I appreciate you guys holding us accountable, though, for not covering Long Beach State in Hawaii in the Big West season. So we did not want to disappoint you guys today, okay? We got up extra early to watch this because it was on past my bedtime last night. Wow.
This might be one of my favorite matches, definitely this year, that I've watched. It was so entertaining. And right off the bat, one of the things that I found the most interesting was that both teams were missing their starting opposite.
Yeah.
Which is just a fascinating dynamic, because that's generally your highest point scorer. In this case, both very good players, although I did think going into the match that it would hinder Hawaii more than it hindered Long Beach.
I agree. I personally have not been a huge Hrstinovic fan. I feel like we're going to have some controversial statements come up during this segment. So just like hang tight for those hot takes. I'm sure I'll get some feedback. But I personally have not been a Hrstinovic fan through the season. I thought Tetriski would be a huge loss. Although they did beat Long Beach State without Tetriski in Big West play. And I was like, who is this Nato Dickinson coming in? Let me tell you, he shut me up so fast after he literally flayed the defense on the first few swings he took. I was like,
this kid, This kid was unbelievable. He detonated balls. It was, I mean, it was wild. For him to come in and take that role and play the way he played in a championship match to go to nationals, knowing you're the backup, I mean, kudos to him. He had 33 attempts and he hit 485. He was unconscious. He was so good.
That's a pretty good stat line.
And I was actually really looking forward to it because the right side for Hawaii started the first set and was all world. I think he went 7-for-9 in the first set. I think it's Finnegan.
Finn Kearney.
Yeah, Finn Kearney. That was, so I thought they were going to go back and forth. Now, Finn kind of fell off as the match went on, but Dickinson was amazing. And one thing I do want to bring up, Hawaii's fan sign game might be the best in the world. Maybe the best in the world.
There is this mother-daughter duo in particular. I've watched a lot of Hawaii volleyball this season. There's this mother-daughter duo who come with like a stack of these signs and they are so good.
Very clever.
So good. But like the Hawaii fan base in general, these signs are, they add to the viewing experience, let me tell you.
My favorite, I think, was the no beach ... access. I put up when they got lost.
Well, that was one that was like, so long, beach.
It was a lot of fun. The atmosphere in the gym was great. And I will say, it got a little chippy. I love that too. And the ref came back and like told the players to calm down. Let's be honest, okay? The trash talking is fun. There's a net in between both teams. And quite frankly, and I'm including myself in this, we're volleyball players. There's not going to be any violence on the court. Like, let them go. Let them trash talk. It's fun. I was disappointed with that. But the game itself was incredible.
Man, I'm all about that. The little prolonged stares.
Vargas hitting one ball and landing in a squat position, watching it hit the ground. I actually thought he wasn't super efficient on the night, but he played really good defense. I thought he blocked pretty well. He passed very well. He was under pressure. I liked his game last night.
I think when Long Beach ran the middle, they were very good. And a little freshman middle came in. High pressure environment. And I thought he did great as well. He did send one free ball probably 30 feet out the baseline, which was a bit of a head scratcher. But other than that, I thought he did great.
So I have two questions for you. Overall, because the matches were all pretty close.
The sets were, yeah.
I always do that. The sets were very close. What do you think was the difference? Like, if you have to sum up kind of what happened, because it was very often 2020, 2019, like coming down the stretch, it was close, and then Hawaii would pull ahead.
Well, I think we would always see Long Beach State make a couple back-to-back errors after 20. We would see like a service error followed up by an attacking error followed up by a net call. Or like some combination of that, they would hold it together and then there would be like two or three errors in a row and like that was the difference. And I think honestly, Hawaii played a full team game.
Yeah.
Like their left side, Sakonoko and Roar, have been a little up and down throughout the season. They, you know, when we saw them early, they were outstanding, but they've kind of been okay some games, excellent others. They were, I would standing.
Louis hit a couple of the biggest balls I think I've seen all season. He went up and it detonated on a few, one down the line and I think one out of the back row, that were just spectacular to watch.
And brought them back into set four. Yeah. Hawaii was down 13-7 in set four.
Yep.
Brought them back into it when he was serving to bring it to 13-13 and then went on another run at the very end of the set.
Yep.
Roar got player of the match, like MVP of the tournament.
Yep. He was very good in the match before.
Oh my gosh. Like, it was a full team effort. Like, Hawaii as a unit showed up and everybody did their job. Whereas, and Long Beach State wasn't bad by any means. It was just like they made untimely errors. And here's probably the biggest hot take that we've got.
And I agree with you.
I think Tred Rosenthal outset Moni Nikolov. And quite frankly, if I'm being honest, which you know I am, duh. Nikolov, when things are going sideways, he often tries to do too much. And I know people like are obsessed with this kid. Totally fine. I truly think, and I was an athlete like this, he is a very good all-around skilled volleyball player who was made into a setter. I don't think he's a natural setter. And I think he needs to spend more time focusing on getting his hitters hittable balls as opposed to trying to have all the attention of the defense on him by making fake moves, by swinging as hard as he can. And quite frankly, I'm very convinced he doesn't see the block at all. He just closes his eyes and hits it as hard as he can. I think he needs to focus more on delivering a solid, consistent offense as opposed to being trying to do everything.
I agree with you. I think he's a very, very good setter when he focuses on just doing that.
But how often does that happen?
Well, yeah. There were a couple instances.
There were some very unhittable balls.
Yes. So when you see him kind of jump, fake set, and then try and deliver a ball, some of the left side balls got tight. There was two instances that stick out in my mind. Dickinson was so good all match. It didn't matter if Hawaii knew where the ball was going. He just needed a hittable ball. And there were a couple times, two in particular, where I saw him jump and turn to hit and then flick it back, and it was unhittable. And they lost both of those points, and they were both in critical moments. And that, knowing when to do that and when it's going to hinder your ability to deliver a ball to your team, I don't think he did a great job of that in this match particularly, because there were at least six or seven balls where he tried to do that and it didn't work out in his favor. And I don't think it was gaining him as much as he thought it was. Yeah. And I get you want to do that, like if you're thinking about playing at the next level or for the national team and you want to have that in your toolbox, totally fair. But this maybe wasn't the match to do that. Because when he just sets, location's good, he makes good decisions, I have no issues with it. But he had a couple runs where those balls were not hittable, and they should have been.
And before everybody gets all mad, I feel like I personally am uniquely qualified to speak to this, because little known fact about me, I was a setter, okay? Until my team just was like, no, we need you to hit more. I set for our youth national team, our junior national team. I was a setter until I was 16 years old, okay? I understood the strategy and how to isolate hitters and how to put hitters in a position, and I had good vision to be able to run an offense at the junior national team level. Was I a true setter? No. So I see a lot of similarities between myself at that age when I was setting and Nikolov now. Like, he is very good. He understands the game. He can make incredible athletic moves, and not a lot of people can. But he needs to just, I don't know. I don't think he's a true setter. I like watching Tred's hands more than his.
Fair. I think that if he only went on one real serving run, and his team needs him to serve. If he could have just focused on setting and serving and maybe not worried about everything else, I think there could have been a different outcome, because Long Beach had leads in the third set and in the fourth set. And when the team gets tight, you see him thinking about too many things.
Like, how can I score the point?
Yeah.
And it's like, that is very much a hitter's mentality.
Yeah.
As the level keeps getting better, you're not going to be able to get away with that. Like even, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Even in the set that they won in the third, they had a massive lead and they gave it up. Yeah. And you're up 13-7. And kudos to Louis. He served a couple bombs. But you can't give up a 13-7 lead when you need to win the set. And yeah, I think I agree. Tred outset him on that. You look at the Hawaii middles. Justin Todd was 7-for-9, hit 778. And you had Nuster went 6-for-9, 556. Those aren't massive point scoring numbers, but they kept Long Beach's middles engaged. Like he ran it just enough and then ran the pipe over top. They owned the middle of the court. They opened up the wings for that. Like I just like the way Tred manipulated that game.
And normally my criticism of Tred is the exact opposite of what I just said about Nikolov, in that like for his size, he is not as offensive as I think he could be. I think he struck a good balance this match, though. Like, he was able to, like, read how the game was playing out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his left sides were scoring. His middles were doing well. Like, Carney was holding his own. He trailed off as the match went on. But, like, he didn't necessarily have the need. He took the swings when he had good, solid opportunities. Dumped the ball for match point. Yeah. Like
he took 11 attempts.
He took his opportunities when he had them. And normally I am like, you need to be more aggressive.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Both of them had 11 attempts on the match. Nikolov had 7 kills and 2 errors. And Rosenthal had 5 kills and 2 errors. But watching the match without looking at the stats, it felt like Nikolov tried more. And that Tred was more successful.
Like that's how it definitely timing, felt.
His timing of decision making was better.
It felt like that for sure. The other thing is like they straight up set Nikolov as a right side hitter when he digs or something.
Yeah.
He doesn't get off the net to get an approach. He just kind of like chills there halfway through and just does a step close. Like he is straight up like being used offensively if he digs the ball.
True.
Whereas Tred isn't.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great match. It lived up to the hype. I thought you had ebbs and flows. You had pushback. You had challenges and plays at the net.
Aggressive. Yes. Like, these guys were going for their serves. And, like, I didn't have that same feeling of, like, we are leaving everything we have on the court when I was watching the MIVA final, when I was watching the MPSF final. Like, in the Big West final, I was like, these guys are giving this everything they've got. And if they go down, they are okay going down swinging.
It was a heavyweight fight.
Yeah.
And both teams came out. The passing, I thought, was incredible. Given the serving pressure, and yes, there were some aces. Yes, Long Beach missed a whole bunch of serves.
Well, Long Beach was out acing Hawaii 8-0 going into set 4.
Yeah. Louis brought that
Louis
back
brought
a little
back
bit more.
8-4.
Because so it ended up being 20 errors and 8 aces for Long Beach and 11 errors and 5 aces for Hawaii. But those totals don't dictate, like the serving pressure was intense, but the passing was even better. It was a fantastic match.
If you didn't watch it,
go back and watch it,
either on YouTube or ESPN Plus or something. Like, I can't tell you the number of times I was just, like, stunned.
That might be a national final if it lines up that way. Like, both of those two teams, if they play the way they can play, I think they're going to be hard outs.
That was so fun to watch. I mean, congrats to Hawaii. And that's a tough environment for Long Beach to play in, for sure.
I'm very curious to see. That crowd is amazing. Maybe only second to the Nebraska crowd for
women's games. They are the men's version of Nebraska women's volleyball.
Now, they're a little bit louder, I think. Yeah. A little more boisterous.
Well, Nebraska, you've got like a lot of young people in the crowd. There in Hawaii, I feel like Nebraska, it's like young girls with their parents, and then like, I don't know, fans who have been fans forever.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not like the rowdy, you know, 30-year-old crowd where you see like that in Hawaii a ton. It's a very different vibe, but I would say that they are like the men's equivalent.
Yeah. That's fair. So I'm curious to see if they meet again in a neutral site, what that looks like. Because
Will
it'll
the
be.
Hawaii do the Hawaii fans travel as well as Nebraska volleyball fans?
Yeah, we'll
That's
see.
a lot further to go. Like Hawaii to Ohio, that's tough.
It was a very good match. If you have a chance, go back and watch it.
All right, we're going to jump right into our listener questions because we went a little wild on the weekly highlights.
I enjoyed the men's volleyball this week, okay?
No, we had a lot to talk about. I have zero regrets, don't get me wrong, but I want to dive into these listener questions. So we got some good ones this week. Question number one is, can you spend some time talking about the NCAA men's liberos? How much do they add to the game compared to women's liberos, and who is on your radar this season?
Oh, so the essence of this question is great. You see more rallies in the women's game than you do in the men's game. And so the liberos can be a little bit more noticeable, I think, in that regard. On the men's side, the ability to pass the ball for the libero and cover a decent amount of court in service reception is massive. And I think you see the biggest kind of effect on the game there. Maybe not from necessarily an execution standpoint, but from alleviating some of the service pressure from some of your other passers. So, for example, if you play with a libero who goes, "Hey, I've got both seams," then as a passer, you're like, "Hey, I can just take this seam and I can hit out of that." And generally, both your left sides are hitting front row, back row. So if they only have to pass a little bit of court and then can come in and run their offense, that makes a huge difference on other players in the match where you don't necessarily see that as a fan, but it's a huge effect. And playing with a libero who can pass that court on the men's game is really important.
And I mean, in the women's game, you see them tip the ball a lot more because, I mean, men's players are, I mean, typically faster. So the tips aren't always as effective. But like, because the tips and stuff are so much more involved in women's volleyball, you get to see the liberos make those spectacular diving plays to dig them and stuff, which, because it's not as much a part of the men's game, it kind of gets taken away. I would say in the men's game, it's harder to notice a good libero, but
Yes.
it's easier to notice a bad one.
I totally agree with you. And I think that one other thing where libero on the men's side is on block recovery. So if you're in there and you make a good read on a block and you can dig a ball and extend a rally, I've seen really good plays like that. It just allows your hitters to take a little more risk if they know that you're there covering them. So I think that's also super important. It's important in the women's
Such
game
an
as well. Yeah.
underappreciated skill. Yes, the men's liberos, their block coverage, you don't see that same thing in the women's game, I
Yeah.
would say.
Well, it generally, again, you're hitting
Ball's
the
coming a
ball.
lot faster.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's different and they don't have maybe as much of an effect on the stat sheet as in the women's game. You're not seeing liberos making 22 digs.
25 digs.
Yeah.
Like, no.
But they have a huge impact. And if you have a good libero, it makes a difference.
So I know who my standout liberos of the season were. Do you have any?
I'm terrible with names. I think the libero for Stanford is very good.
Evan Porter.
I also think the libero for USC is very good.
Joni Dykstra.
Yeah, those would be the two that stick
Okay,
out.
my third. I had three on my list.
Okay.
My third is Choi from Hawaii.
That was gonna be. He extended some rallies in that final, and he actually made a few spectacular digs that I thought were very good.
Like those three, I watched a lot of all three of those teams this season,
Yeah.
and those three I consistently was like, I really like this guy. And those are probably the only three liberos that I was like, yeah.
One, I think, if you look at a team who struggles at that position, it's UCLA. They switch the liberos back and forth. I don't think, like, the passing libero kind of gets them in trouble
Yeah.
very often. And you have two outsides there who are pretty good ball control players, but if they could focus a little more on passing and getting outside to hit, I think that would really help UCLA. That to me is a libero that I have noticed in a negative way.
Exactly. Great question.
Great question. One.
All right, this is a long question. Let me bring my computer closer because, you know, my eyeballs are getting old. Okay, so this one's about serving. I understand that you want to serve tough to get the opposing team out of system, but when you're giving the game or match away on constant missed serves, doesn't it defeat the purpose? What ace to error ratio would you want your team to aim for? Because this person is basically asking, why would you not just try to get the ball in and rely on your block defense as opposed to just missing?
This is a very nuanced question.
And I like this question.
I'm going to poke a little fun right at the beginning. What if your block and defense isn't very good? And so different teams will have different styles and different strategies. So let's say you're a really good blocking team and you like to play, you know, a triple block, or blocking out of system is your strength. But if you're in system, your middle doesn't make good decisions and, you know, you don't get many stops. Getting a team out of system is then more important because you're not getting stops if a team is in system. Like, a lot of this defensive structure and serving pressure is kind of calculated on a per team basis based on what your strengths are. Now, if you play really good block defense as a team, then yes, you would take some of that error out and go, we're okay if the ball's in play because we're getting chances. And it differs between the men and the women's game because you have to look at the other team as well. Are they a super high side out team? Like, Long Beach is not very good at defense. They must put serving pressure in an attempt to get blocks.
Get their block involved.
Because they don't generate a ton of points defensively from digs, right? You see Vargas, you see Nikolov. Yeah. That's not their team strength. And so your serving and the type of serving you do needs to play into your team identity.
But conversely, you don't want to just get the serve in against Long Beach State because they have so many weapons. And if a team has three or four options on an attack, you're basically missing a serve anyway. Like, that's kind of the thought process of, like, this team is so good that if I just get the serve in and give them almost a free ball, it's basically the same result as missing a serve. So you're definitely playing the percentages and who is in the front row, who's, like, on offense. Like, if you have the setter in the front row and their middle's not good, yeah, it's easy to just serve the left side short, keep it in, and then overload over to the left side. But, like, there's so much evaluation that has to take into account. I do agree with you. It is very frustrating to watch a match that is just missed serves.
Yeah.
That is not fun to watch for anybody. But there's so much to consider when weighing your risk to reward and in response to the part of, like, what ace to error ratio are you looking for? For women, if you're float serving, I think you're typically looking for 1-to-1. And if you're spin serving, like 1-to-1.5 or 2. On the men's side, it's a lot higher. So I would say if you're spin serving on the men's side, if you're doing 1-to-2.5 ace to error, you're doing pretty well.
Two other things to think about. One of them may not come intuitively is, if you put an easy serve in and the team gets a good side out, that team builds rhythm. They build connection with their setter. The hitters feel good. They're getting kills.
Passers feel good.
Exactly. If you go miss serve, you don't touch the ball, you haven't passed, there's no rhythm, and then you get bomb, 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 and you're a little bit out of system, it works that way too. So keeping a team out of rhythm, while it may not be fun to watch, also plays a point in that. And then teams will also have certain rotations. So you mentioned if the setter's in the front row and teams know they're just going to set their left side and go over top of your setter, for those three rotations, you look at your servers and go, you have the green light to just hit this as hard as you want because we're probably not going to score anyway. And teams will look at certain rotations and go, okay, when we have these three guys in the front row, we're really going to work to keep it in because we turn a lot of points. So there are, not only do you have team philosophies and things that you're good at, but you also have rotational philosophies depending on what your matchups are.
And who your server is.
Yeah.
Like Nikolov always has the green light to just go as hard as he wants.
Yeah.
Because he gets a ton of aces.
Yeah. Great question.
Great question. Question three is, as an attacker, how many times do you swing with a trajectory in mind and hope to avoid the block versus being able to see the block before you attack? Similarly, when attackers intentionally aim for the top of hands, do they typically see the position of the hands, or are they just predicting where the hands will be? I think we might have different answers.
So there are definitely some players who see the block and some players who don't see the block. Well, I know why you're laughing. So it's really interesting. When I played on the right side of the court as a right-handed opposite, I often found it hard to see the block just because the ball's coming over your shoulder, you're trying to find it. That was just something that I struggled with. There are lots of really good hitters in this position who don't struggle to see the block. However, when I moved to the left side and my approach opened up and I could see the whole court, it was definitely, you could definitely see the block and the defense coming into play. So it depends on what you're looking at, your angle of approach, what the situation is, and then your kind of innate experience with that. But definitely good hitters see the block.
I would say if you're playing at a high level, you see the block. Even when I'm a lefty on the left side, like for me, when I would have to hit left side, I would always position myself and line up my approach angle to be able to see the block. Like if a set got off the net or something happened, it was like very rare and very uncomfortable if I was in a situation where I couldn't see the block. You can tell actually when players can see the block or not just based on the decisions they make.
Mm-hmm.
As far as there are some players who can see the block and see the entire defense behind the block as well. That is much more rare. I would say the majority of high level attackers for sure see the block, but there's an elite separate group that can see everything. In response to your question about aiming for hands, I honestly think a lot of it depends on the hitter's size, jumping ability, contact point. Like a smaller hitter, it is much easier to see the hands because you're below them. A bigger hitter or a hitter who plays very high above the net, when you're hitting, so that was me as a bigger attacker. My contact point above the net was very high. I was often higher or taller than the blockers. So you see the bodies, you see the arms, but because you're kind of above the blockers, it's harder to see the fingertips. As a smaller hitter, the fingertips are above you, so it's much easier to find that. So that's why you see like smaller hitters or players who don't jump very well are usually very good at finding the hands. So yeah, you do want to be able to see.
Yeah. The other thing about this is that once you've done it enough, there's a certain amount of pattern recognition and automation that happens as a hitter. So you're in system, you're coming up, you're doing your approach. You know, you see maybe the middle bites with your middle. You know that you have one blocker and you'll be able to see their body and kind of know where their hands will be because of that. You see the blocker close, you know, and you know you're going to have four hands solid. So you have different options. So it's not always a cognizant decision, but because you've played so much and you watch film and you prepare, some of those cues kind of allow you to make those decisions very quickly.
Well, and that's why sometimes you see this more on the beach because it's a one-on-one block, but like when you see one-on-one block situations, the reason a lot of the time that the hitter does get blocked is because they see the hitter's body, the blocker's body, but if the blocker makes a really big move and the arm position doesn't line up with the body position, that is where the disconnect comes in. Because you, as a hitter, you inherently, your brain tells you where the body is, the arms will be straight. But when you see a body and the arms go really big in one direction, that is where the disconnect comes in and how one-on-one blockers are able to make those plays. Our final question of the week is referring to sort of a blurred line in the skills of opposites and outside hitters. So this person, as we've talked about, there's usually one outside hitter that is predominantly a point scorer, maybe a little weaker with ball control, and the other that their strength is ball control and they're not relied upon as heavily to score points. So this person is like, isn't an opposite similar to the outside that scores the points? Like, isn't their skill set very similar? So how do teams determine which player plays opposite and which player plays the point scoring left side role? And the athlete they were referring to in this question was Logan Eggleston.
So the very first one is, can you pass or can you not pass? That's generally...
So like, for the point scoring left side, oftentimes their passing leaves a lot to be desired.
And it's usually still better than the opposite.
You're not wrong.
I mean, we kind of made fun of Hawk for not being able to play defense. Like, she, I don't know this, but if I was a betting man, I would say is not a very good passer.
Well, no. And like, the person referred to Logan Eggleston because we have said that her defense isn't great.
Right.
Like, passing is like up and down. So it's like, well, why wouldn't Madison Skinner just play that position? And then Eggleston plays right side.
Yeah.
Like, that's the essence of it.
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple things. So one is, a lot of times if you were a middle, you will transition to the right side first so that you can kind of feel the flow of the game from a different position. And then maybe you move to a left side or you learn to pass. That's a very common progression that happens. I think the other one too is, you know, sometimes you just have super physical athletes who are even better than your top left side. Because you don't always see a team with a true P1 who scores a ton of points.
Or gets set out of the back row.
Exactly. So there's a couple things. Some players attack better on the right side of the court than the left side of the court. Is your hitter left-handed? Some right-handed hitters can drop their shoulder and hit down the line. Some really struggle with that. Like, there are...
Are they semi-competent at passing and defense? If the answer is no, probably a right side.
Yeah. So...
Are they very powerful from the back row? Probably want to use them on the right side.
Well, and blocking comes into play there as well. Mm-hmm. Some people block better to the right. They have a better, stronger hand outside. Like, there's lots of factors as to why athletes would be on the right versus the left. And some of those, maybe you grew up playing club or on your pro team and you could have played left side, but you were the third best passer and they wanted you on the floor, so you played right side. There's all kinds of scenarios like that which determine whether you end up on the right or the left.
Great questions this week, everybody.
Yeah, very good.
Love those.
All right. So we have another great week of volleyball for you to watch.
It's a little less packed. Less going on.
But still lots of good games.
Yeah.
The Men's Italian League finals are happening. The second match is on Thursday and the third match is on Sunday. Both of those you can watch on VBTV and they should be very competitive matches. We also have PVF matches this week. Vegas, Indy, and Grand Rapids are fighting for their lives. They need to keep winning in order to give themselves a chance. Grand Rapids has got Orlando at 7 o'clock Eastern on a Wednesday. That's on Roku. And Omaha at 7 p.m. Eastern on Friday. That's on Fox Sport 2. Vegas has got Orlando at 10 p.m. Eastern on Friday. That's on Volleyball TV. And Columbus at 9 o'clock Eastern on Sunday. And that's on CBS. You should check all of the websites out because that's a lot of different places to watch games.
So many different ones.
Finally, Indy is playing Atlanta at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursday and San Diego at 9 o'clock Eastern. And both of those are on Roku. So there's lots of...
I'm not even sure. I think all three of these teams have got a challenge match and a winnable match.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. One kind of ranked team or one team that's ahead of them. And
like a match that'll really, they're going to have to show up, and one that like, obviously they're still going to have to show up, yeah, but like winnable. Do you know what I mean?
Well, and this is obviously outside of playoffs, the most fun time to watch. Which teams rise to the occasion? Who crumbles under pressure? What happens when you have to win? I love watching sports at this time of the year.
Give me the meltdowns, baby.
Yeah, it's always fun.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.